This is your Planet News Briefing.
I'm John Chu.
And I'm Ralph Forgeon.
Our main story coming up is an interview with Dr. Shahir Masri, who is a scientist, professor, author of Beyond Debate, and co-founder of On the Road for Climate Action.
We talked to him about engaging others about the climate crisis.
But first, your Planet News headlines for this week.
In politics news this week, NorthJersey.com, a USA Today affiliate, reports New Jersey becomes first state to incorporate climate change in K-12 curriculum. So this takes effect in September of 2021 and 2022. And the state will offer a broad outline that will allow school districts to craft instruction based on why the planet is warming and what can be done to mitigate it. Governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, launched an outline on reaching 100% clean energy by 2050. The governor has gotten mixed reviews from environmentalists on his clean energy goals, ranging from praise for blocking a proposed natural gas pipeline to criticism for allowing New Jersey Transit to move forward with building a gas-fired power plant.
Interesting. Well, first of all, why is it September 2021 and 2022?
It's staggered across the school districts.
Okay. Well, this is ultimately a good thing. When you teach children or kids K-12 curriculum around climate change, and hopefully they, you know, learn at a younger age, relatively speaking, and to take action, and they have more of their life ahead of them to make a difference, right? We actually reported on this months ago. It was Italy that actually requires now the public school system to learn about climate change in their school curriculum. So it's great to see one state, be it just one state, it is a whole state in the US, taking charge and incorporating this into the public school system.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So in business news this week, the New York Times reports that economic giants are restarting. So as countries begin rolling out plans to restart their economies after the brutal shock inflicted by the coronavirus, three big producers of planet warming gases, which are the EU, the US, and China, are basically writing scripts that push humanity into very different directions. So take Europe, for example. This week, they laid out a vision of a green future with a proposed recovery package worth more than $800 billion. That would transition away from fossil fuels and put people to work, making old buildings more energy efficient. Fantastic. In the US, meanwhile, the White House is steadily slashing environmental protections, and Republicans are using the Green New Deal as a way to go against their opponents. So that's interesting. And also in China, China has given a green light to build new coal plants, but it also declined to set specific economic growth targets for the year, a move that came as a result or as a relief to environmentalists because it reduces the pressure to turn up the country's industrial machine quickly. So this is interesting. The virus-induced lockdowns across, you know, these parts of the world have resulted in a sharp drop in greenhouse gas emissions in recent months, but the decline was nowhere near enough to shake loose the thick blanket of gases that already wraps the planet, according to New York Times. And more importantly, greenhouse gases are expected to go back up as these countries reopen. So especially if the recovery packages don't pivot away from fossil fuels.
All right, in tech news this week, Triple Pundit reports carbon recycling offers hope for more sustainable air travel. So this is about the airline industry, and it has been working its way towards a biofuel solution. In February of this year, the ASTM International, the agency that certifies jet fuel, introduced a fast-track process for biofuel producers with guidance from the Federal Aviation Administration. So there are a couple interesting initiatives around jet biofuel at the moment. There's one called with Chevron called the Loomis Global Venture. It's partnered with the firm Applied Research Associates to develop a 50-50 blend of petroleum and waste grease for jet fuel. The Formula One ATSM, this organization that we just mentioned, approval in February, and plans are in the works to produce it at scale for the markets in the US and Japan. Other biofuels are generated from crop waste or other fuels such as biomass, likely trees, as we've talked about in the past. However, there's other kind of more interesting materials in this space, being algae. So it might be a little bit easier, faster to grow, and you're not cutting down trees. The most exciting trend, though, however, is in microbiology. So there's this one area, LanzaTech, has developed a robust micro-based carbon recycling process that deploys living organisms to digest waste gas emitted during steel production with substantial assistance from the U.S. Department of Energy. So pretty cool. Put this on steel production emission and possibly turn that into fuel. So interesting concepts.
One is really cool. Much better than using biomass. Talked about biomass recently. That sounds pretty good, but when you dig into it, and especially when you watch that documentary by Michael Moore and the destruction to, you know, habitats, trees, forests, and whatnot, it's just so devastating. So biomass is an alternative, but it's not the ideal one, is it?
Yeah, it'd be interesting in terms of these kind of efficiencies in microbes and just bioengineering to be able to kind of produce these than just going down and cutting down trees.
Yeah, I agree. So lastly, in science news this week, according to Bloomberg, a massive fuel spill in Siberia prompted Russia to declare a state of emergency in the region, as the mining company involved said that the catastrophe was caused by climate change. Scientists have warned for years that thawing of once permanently frozen ground covering more than half of Russia is threatening the stability of buildings and pipelines. So Greenpeace said last week that last week's incident was the largest ever in the Arctic region, and likened it to the Exxon spill off Alaska in 1989. So if you've seen photos of this, it looks very, very massive spill. Like this area of ice is literally covered in red or orange liquid. And it's devastating to see, because you can tell from the photos the scale that it is. So just to be specific, the cause of the spill, in which 20,000 tons of diesel or about 150,000 barrels leak from a reservoir owned by MMC, Norilsk Nickel. So it hasn't been determined, but the company has suggested it could be the result of damage from melting permafrost. The rate of warming in general in the Arctic is twice as fast as the rest of the world. Not to get overly political here, but it's worth noting that President Vladimir Putin approved a state of emergency Wednesday, which was 5 days after the spill. That's pretty dramatic there, lots of days in between. Putin criticized the handling of the incident, said that he only learned about the scale of the incident from social media 2 days after it occurred.
Interesting.
It's a poor job of handling it, isn't it?
Crazy. Yeah, that is insane in terms of the permafrost threatening infrastructure there. That'll be definitely interesting to watch. All right, coming up, our main story, an amazing conversation with Dr. Shahir Masri, scientist, professor, author of Beyond Debate, and co-founder of On the Road for Climate Action.
Shahir, thank you for agreeing to be on our podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Look, we're big fans of your work. Have your book, Beyond Debate. I did send you a message about whether or not you have an audiobook, because I almost exclusively listen to audiobooks. But for this one, I actually bought the book, and I have a handheld book, which I haven't bought in such a long time. But
thank you.
We are subscribers of your monthly newsletter, and you know, enjoy watching your stuff on YouTube and following your past road trips, I guess, across America for climate action. So big fans of your work, and thank you for being on our show.
It's all great to hear. Absolutely. My pleasure. And I'm glad that, glad to see people making use of the work that I'm putting out there. So appreciate it.
Yeah. We were just talking at the beginning, before we started recording, that I think either I found you on Instagram or you found me, and we just connected and started to like each other's content and whatnot. And then I remember just looking through your background and seeing Chapman University, and that's Ralph, that's actually your alma mater, isn't it? So I, yeah. And Ralph, we messaged each other saying, hey, do you know him? Can we get him on the show? And
that's great how things work out. Yeah, the world of social media connecting us all.
Yeah, but look, how are you doing in such a, what is inevitably a wild start to 2020 with COVID-19 and much more recently with the Black Lives Matter protests across the states. We're in the UK, by the way, but we are American, so we can feel the tension and you know, kind of experience it, because obviously we're a bit devastated as well. But like, what's it like in the States, boots on the ground?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm doing okay. It's certainly been a heavy few months, as you know, we can all attest. And I think that having the protesting and just yet another incident of police brutality. I mean, this is definitely, like I said, a heavy start to 2020. But these changes, speaking of the, you know, the social justice side, are extremely important. And I think that it's great to see people really taking democracy at you know, at sort of in their own hands, as it should be. You know, this is a democracy where people have the right to protest, and that's how we get change in this country. And I'm glad to see such you know, peaceful protests in most parts of the country taking place. I'm actually writing an article for The Hill right now, which is tying together social justice and the environment in an article that's going to really dive into some of the history of environmental justice in the country, because beyond police brutality and your sort of more classical cases of social injustices, we also have this big issue of environmental injustice, where typically people of color and low income are disproportionately subjected to higher levels of toxic pollution, whether it be pollution in the air, water, and soil. So I think it's an important time to shine a light on that as well. And of course, as we get into the issue of climate change, that's a huge environmental justice issue as well, where we're seeing people all across the world. Those in the low-income countries and the less sort of financially endowed countries standing to suffer the most as we see these environmental changes take place.
That's a good point to bring up. Definitely, we do have a podcast that we kind of dive into the environmental injustice due to climate crisis. So yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, that was a heavy episode for us, Ralph. We because we came from a, I mean, we had a huge disclosure here and at the beginning of that episode, where we said, look, you know, we realized that you know, we grew up in, you know, a, you know, with both parents, and we had, you know, a really good upbringing, and you know, we have jobs and stuff now. So, but at the same time, we focused that episode on the people who were, you know, quite the opposite. And it really, just doing the research and preparing for the podcast and actually recording the podcast and then knowing that people were listening to us talk about that topic, like for me, it made me really, you know, realize for the first time how much injustice there is.
There's a map that I show in one of my courses that it draws the world map scaled to the extent to which different countries are either contributing to or bearing the consequences of climate change. And Africa, to give an example, in the map that's showing causes of climate change, Africa is scaled down to basically the size of a tiny little peninsula on the global map. But then when you look at the global map viewed through the lens of countries standing to suffer the most, Africa becomes basically, it takes up the whole map. That's just a really stark example right there of exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. Look, so we touched a little bit about COVID-19 and what's happening in the U.S. with the Black Lives Matter protests and so forth. We're about to jump into another heavy matter, which is climate change. And it does tie into, you know, like COVID-19 and racism against the Black community, because climate change will impact Black communities pretty hard. I mean, you talked about your upcoming work or things that you're going to publish. And I know that in the U.S., like different parts of the South, for example, Black communities through redlining, I think is what it's called, when like different real estate is determining where, you know, Black Black folks are living in the U.S. and therefore just from the start, children are not having the same, equal opportunities to just starting out from school just because of where they're living. And a lot of times those places where those communities are stationed, they're so close to landfills and so forth. And that stuff does feed into, what they're breathing, what they're eating.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been a fair amount of research showing that color communities of color typically have fewer grocery stores, an increased number of liquor stores, more fast food. And getting into COVID-19, as you're mentioning, higher density housing, which of course makes it harder to socially distance, multi-generational housing where the elderly folks are living within the same house as basically all the other family, again, making it more difficult to socially distance. We have a higher proportion of people of color that occupy occupations in the service industry, which are many of which are deemed critical infrastructure, nurses, food, agriculture, and basically have been working throughout the entire pandemic, rendering them even more vulnerable. And then, of course, we've got the whole jail prison system, which has enriched a higher proportion of people of color. And of course, COVID-19 presents particular risks in those tight living conditions as well.
Yeah, look, we're already going off our little cheat sheet here because it's so natural to just want to engage on all of these things. But let's just take a step back, if you don't mind, Shahir, and just talk about your background. Tell us a bit about yourself, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I'm currently working as a research scientist at the University of California, Irvine, just south of Los Angeles, about an hour south. And my academic background actually also stems from Los Angeles. I was an undergraduate at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, and I studied environmental science there. And because of my interest in pollution, air pollution specifically, I decided to apply to graduate programs in environmental health. And I wound up at Harvard University, where I spent 2 years in the master's program and another 4 years in the doctoral program, specializing in environmental health and, in fact, it's environmental exposure assessment. Most of the work I've done is related to air pollution. I'm currently working on air pollution related work right now, but also looking at soil contamination. So basically any environmental chemical exposures that one can think of in the environment would pertain to, the type of work that I'd be looking at. And of course, my primary focus, air pollution, fits right in with the global climate change issue. Of course, anthropogenic carbon dioxide and methane and other emissions are driving temperatures up, increasing the greenhouse effect. So I've taken a focus, sort of a side focus in my career, to really start focusing on outreach. I think there's a lot of great science that has been published already on the issue of climate change. So one aspect of my career now is just, and this is the sort of unpaid aspect of my career, but basically just thinking about how we can get more of this science out to the public, how we can inform communities about what we already know or have a good understanding about. So that's sort of me in a nutshell in terms of my background and training and what I'm looking to do right now in science and outreach.
Yeah, that's amazing.
We're very lucky to be speaking to you with such a great background here and kind of what you've been doing. I guess before we go into kind of the things that you've done in terms of outreach, what is kind of the overall mission you're looking to achieve in outreach, and then what has been really successful in translating that, I guess, basically in terms of what kind of content you're putting out and how people are engaging with that.
I think I've been very positively received in the communities that I've been outreaching to, both in person and through social media. I think that there's a real need for scientists to sort of speak up a little bit more and be spokesmen for the science that people are interested in hearing about and are learning about. So I think that many of the presentations I've given audience members are excited to have an actual scientist come and speak to them about these issues. So I think the more we can encourage other scientists to do the same. And I always do that when I speak to colleges. I try to encourage people to, when they finish their degrees and jump into the field, to not forget about outreach and communicating to the public. In terms of my goals are basically to to shed a light on the climate impacts and the causes that are related to climate change. I think that, you know, there's been just decades of inaction on this issue. We had a really good understanding of climate crisis a long time ago, and it's only gotten stronger. And what's really, I think, lacking is an effective communication of that science. Some of it's intentional smearing of climate science, which has led to a lot of public confusion. And some of it is just, you know, the fact that everyday people are busy and it's hard to really make sense of different news headlines, especially when they're conflicting. But I think that if everybody knew what the science was saying and wasn't wondering if it's true or not true, or, you know, debating this or that, if people just knew what the science was saying, they'd really want to take action. They'd want to take action for themselves, for their children, for their grandchildren, and for future generations. And I think that, and for the environment around us. So I don't think of the globe and the United States, I don't think of people around the world, some just, you know, not caring about climate change. It's just that they don't think it's a threat. So my goal is to really shine a light on the science that is suggesting that we have a big problem on our hands. And I think that the will to act will then come naturally.
And that's precisely what I enjoy about your book, because you break down science behind climate change from different angles in a really easy to understand way. And I think that was it, your intentional approach, wasn't it?
That's correct. It was meant for the everyday person. I'm not speaking to scientists. I'm speaking to everyone else.
Yeah. So let's talk about your book a little bit more. I mentioned it's called Beyond Debate, but what, you know, just talk about that so that our audience can also learn about it and hopefully pick it up, because it's one of the best books that I've read in terms of understanding the science. And I love how you go back and forth and trying to talk about the angle of the denier along with, you know, the person that is converted. So just talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you for that. And I think, again, my intention behind this book was to give sort of a user's manual, if you will, a resource to everyday people to better understand the climate crisis. And an important aspect of that was to not write a convoluted book filled with scientific jargon and a bunch of graphs. Really kept graphs to a minimum. I think I only have 5 figures in the whole text, and 50 chapters, each debunking a separate climate misconception. So there's 50 misconceptions that are commonly out there that I speak to. Chapters are relatively short, but they're thorough and detailed. I have over 270 references, so you can go to the back of the book and do more research if you want to find out where certain things came from. One part of the book that I think some people appreciate is you don't have to read it in order. Again, it's sort of like a field guide to understanding climate change and climate misconceptions. So you can just kind of look through the chapter headings and pick any topic that you hear about. If a person you know is saying, oh, well, you know, scientists can't possibly understand the past climate, well, I've got a chapter on that. You can just go right to it and sort of flip through it. I think that there's a need for that sort of reference guide, and also a book that talks about climate misconceptions in a non sort of condemnatory way. There's some, you know, literature out there, both online and hard copy, that sort of is so clearly meant for, you know, liberal, progressive, passionate climate activists that it sort of condemns the other side. And I think it's important to have a book written out there accessible to every person that's not going to turn anyone away. And it's just going to speak to the science and hopefully inspire and encourage people to share it with others.
Yeah, and I, you know, that when I was reading it, I was also surprised how recent it is, because you talk about President Donald Trump, you talk about the EPA and what's going on. So it's very up to date. Yeah, go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, this was published in 2018, right after Scott Pruitt had resigned. In fact, I had to update that chapter just shy of it going to press. I was like, I gotta update it. We have some new information.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, and I think I cheated a little bit, because I heard you on other podcasts and you mentioned that you might have another book coming out.
That's true. I haven't talked about this very much at all. So you've heard one of the few podcasts where I discussed it. I am very much in the writing phase of book number 2, which is sort of a memoir of the National Climate Outreach Project that I launched in 2018. We were on the road for a good portion of the year, speaking to people across 42 different states, hearing from people afflicted by climate change. And now I'm in the process each month of trying to bring videos to the public on my website, sharing some of the story. But importantly, I wanted to write down that story in the form of a book that captures the story of climate change. So most books that I've read on climate change are very much about the issue from a, you know, parts per million perspective, pie charts and graphs and things like that. But I think that we're missing the human component. And there's a lot of stories to be told about climate change and the impacts that are being realized around the world. And my goal, not only through the grassroots project around the country, but now through this book, is to bring those stories to the public and share what people are experiencing, because I think that people relate with human experiences, and that's such a big part of climate change and climate impacts. So this book, who knows when it'll go to press. Right now, the goal is basically writing some of these chapters down and sending it to an agent and finding a publisher, and that can be a pretty arduous process. So I'll keep you updated.
Well, that's amazing. I did watch some of your content regarding your road trips, which is very much like what a presidential candidate would do, traveling across places, shaking hands. So I guess you won't be shaking hands anymore. But that's amazing what you did, you and your partner. Yeah?
It's true. Yeah. Athena, my now fiance, we were, we kind of joked that it felt like it actually felt like a political campaign. I would think that all the time. And in fact, I think we overlapped with some of the political campaigns that were taking place around the country. And I totally empathize with what these candidates have to go through. They're just constantly on the move, giving speeches. Sometimes I was giving 3 talks a day, and it was just very exhausting by the end of the day. So yeah, it's pretty wild what politicians do on a regular basis.
Speaking of the scientific outreach and of the importance of this, definitely have seen this from other scientists as well, bringing up this topic. Are you seeing a kind of a transition of that? Are you seeing more scientists trying to do more outreach, or how do you see that?
I definitely feel like I'm seeing a shifting tide where it's becoming more accepted for scientists to speak out. And I think that there's been a long tradition of scientists basically staying in the lab and publishing papers, and it was almost, I don't know, maybe stepping down from the ivory tower was, I don't know if it was scary or just beneath, you know, the idea of science. But there's just such a pressing issue in our hands, environmental issue, that I think many people are finally starting to recognize the important role that scientists need to play if we're to really pull out of this climate change issue. And at this point, of course, we're committed to some amount of climate change, but if we're to steer ourselves on a positive trajectory, we're going to need voices from all fields. Mm-hmm. And I am starting to see some of that. And I think it was 1986 where James Hansen from NASA, he was sort of the first bold scientist that I can think of that really got on the Senate floor and started testifying to about the climate science. But it took a while for a trickling effect to sort of resound through the scientific community. But I think now we're starting to see a little bit more of a critical mass where more scientists are getting out there.
That's amazing. Amazing. And by the way, I did see that you were actually at the NASA location in Florida recently?
So I just published a video online that you might be referring to where we were actually in Houston at the NASA Space Center in Houston, actually, Texas. So that was just last spring, actually. So that video, it was sometime on our road for action. And it was pretty thrilling to see all of those sites that you saw in the video where astronauts actually train. So that was pretty cool. And also just hearing a bit from that NASA scientist that I interviewed was really interesting about what NASA's sort of role with climate science has been.
I think that you've really built sort of a reputation around breaking down science in a really easy to absorb manner. It sounds like this next book that you're that you're currently writing, where it's a summary of your human experiences and this campaign across America. It sounds like this is going to play in that theme as well, where it's going to be stories that people can relate to, can understand, can appreciate. I think that's such an interesting angle for a scientist to talk about such a complex issue, right?
Yeah, and I should mention that I also, as a scientist, there's no way I could write a book without incorporating science in there to some extent. So I sort of see this book as being an overlap of what I had already explained, but also understanding climate impacts as they're taking place around the country. So, you know, from the West Coast to the Northeast to the southern tip of Florida, there's so many impacts happening, from sea level rise to, you know, these bomb cyclones up in the Northeast to heat waves and fires in the West. So bringing those statistics into the book, and sort of, you know, anybody who wants to get an idea as to what climate change means in the United States, that'll be accessible in this book through just the variety of key statistics that I think are important to point out.
Excellent. Yeah. I mean, it's not just the book and the book coming on the way, but obviously lectures, articles, you mentioned an article already earlier on this episode, podcast episode, but research, you've got videos, you've got events, you know, when you did the campaign and so forth. It's just really amazing that your engagement or your angle to helping solve climate change is through just engagement on a personal level in a really relatable manner.
I'm doing what I can, you know, and you always want to be able to do more. But, you know, having these conversations on podcasts such as yours are examples of, you know, reaching new audiences. And I think it's so important. So I equally appreciate what you both are doing. I think it's of critical importance.
Excellent. In the interest of time, should we go to traffic lights?
So I'll explain quickly. So basically, in terms of the traffic light section, we do kind of a red, yellow, and green, if you have them. It's good to stretch for them if you can, but a red being kind of on the topic, and we can kind of go into anything of your past experience or just climate crisis in general. What is something kind of like a warning you see in terms of red? A yellow being something that kind of caution in the area, and a green is, you know, something that you see is very positive kind of around the topic. I'm gonna start with the green. I mean, I definitely think the green is by far the scientist outreach. I mean, I think it's super critical, like you've said, and it's incredible to see people like yourself doing it. I definitely think it's probably hard to find that combination of somebody that has that scientific technical, you know, acumen, but also can go out and you know, jump on social media and stuff, and it's super awesome that you're doing that and doing YouTube and all of it. So really impressive. A yellow for me, it's, you know, definitely a stretch. But I think you touched it as well in terms of at the beginning of our conversation around kind of the social injustices that happen within climate change as well, and within environment. That's going to be really interesting in terms of what you can kind of material you put together for that as well. And then I don't really have a red, so I'm gonna skip on my red for today, which is unlike me. But let's go on to you, Jean.
Yeah. Well, I do have a red, and just because before this episode started, and knowing Shahir's background, which is a lot of it's about education and engagement, and first thing I thought about was just information overload. I mean, with the sources of information at our fingertips, online, anywhere, you're just so close to fake news and just like bots and online trolls and so forth. I think that people are, I mean, to me, a red is just the fact that anyone can get any information and just kind of could overlook the source of it and how true that information is, right? And that to me is a danger to engagement. But equally, going into my yellow is there are so many platforms. I mean, there's platforms for good and bad, right? I mean, I talked about some of the bad, but there's also lots of good stuff that's available at people's fingertips. I think that's incredible. Ralph, you talked a little bit about the options that people have, YouTube, social media, just any place online and so forth, different forums, Reddit and whatnot. Mike Green is actually scientists like Shahir, because look, before reaching out to you, or even before we started this podcast, Ralph, you know, like, I never thought that we can just reach out to such an accomplished scientist and get him on our show and talk about all of the, you know, the content he's put out, the books and so forth, and someone who's kind of traveled across America doing a campaign around, you know, the climate action and so forth. The Green for me is essentially just being able to get in touch with experts and learn directly from them, be inspired by them, and then also put them on a podcast where we are just doing, and then as a result, you know, we're extending this podcast to other people, and hopefully they're learning about Shahir's work and being inspired by it, and hopefully they're going out and you know, taking action as well.
Great. I think am I supposed to give a red light, green light as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want to.
Yeah, no, it's fine. So for me, a red light is just where we've come with climate change in terms of climate impacts with temperatures, with carbon dioxide emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. We've really been on a sharp path of increasing emissions for the last few decades. And we've been met with extremely large hurdles in terms of curbing greenhouse gas emissions. Profit always somehow seems to supersede, you know, other issues of importance, and we're still seeing that play out. A yellow light would be the challenges that continue to lay ahead. As I mentioned, there's still a system in place that is giving, you know, fossil fuel companies and the sort of business as usual pathway momentum, and I think that that's going to continue to be a challenge. We still have major subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, and we still see hurdles for renewable energy. Having said that, I think that the green light is the fact that we are starting to see a massive uptick in renewable energy, particularly over the last 10 years. We've seen the solar and wind ramp up dramatically in the United States and elsewhere. And another green light aspect is, you know, things like Greta Thunberg, which are very encouraging, seeing the youth movement really start to get active about climate change, and social media start to really talk about climate change. So I think that's really encouraging. When I was on the road talking to communities, I gave a talk to a junior high school, and those kids were so informed about climate change, I almost felt like I had no use talking to them. It was a really inspiring moment. So to see up and coming generations with that level of knowledge and understanding about this issue, I think is definitely a green light.
I love that one. All right, Shahir, it's been absolute pleasure and blast having you on the show.
Likewise, it's been a pleasure as well.
Cool. Yeah, in terms of how can people reach you?
So the best way to reach me would be to go to my website, which is shahirmosri.com. You can also get there by going to roadforaction.com. And you can also check out my Instagram, which is dr.shahirmosri. But if you go to my website, you'll find a way to subscribe to my monthly newsletter. You can find my Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, all that stuff on my website. So my website. So shahirmosri.com is sort of a one-stop shop if you want to tap into my work.
I think that's awesome. I think, people who are listening don't have the ability to kind of see you right now, whereas Ralph and I were doing the Zoom conference and we're just, you know, able to see each other. And it's just really nice to talk to a scientist who actually, you know, looks very much relatable and reachable. And all your content on social media, it really does do a good job of displaying, you know, just how human you are, I guess. And you're doing a lot of good work, so I appreciate everything you're doing in this space. And hopefully, you know, people out there will start to follow you on social media and follow your work and learn and be inspired to take action.
Well, thanks for putting a spotlight on my work and on this topic. It's really appreciated.
And that is this week's Your Planet News Briefing.
I'm Ralph Forgeon.
I'm John Chu.
Thanks for listening.